Today is Friday, July 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump disavows controversial chants by his supporters at a rally.
I didn't say that. They did. But I disagree with
it. But they were echoing what you said in your first tweet, that they didn't go back.
Well, I don't think if you examine it, I don't think you'll find that. But I disagree with it.
Shoots down an Iranian drone after it comes within 1,000 meters of an American ship. Also ahead.
Atop the rocket inside the Apollo spacecraft, named Columbia after Jules Verne's spacecraft, are the first men who will attempt to land on the moon.
A window inside how VOA covered the Apollo mission to the moon in 1969. It's all on today's International Edition. Iran said Thursday that its Revolutionary Guard seized a foreign oil tanker and its crew of 12 for smuggling fuel out of the country, and hours later released a video showing the vessel to be a United Arab Emirates-based ship that had vanished in Iranian waters over the weekend. The announcement solved one mystery, the fate of the missing ship, but raised a host of other questions and heightened worries about the free flow of traffic in the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's most critical petroleum shipping routes. One-fifth of global crude exports passes through the strait.
The United States has blamed Iran for a series of attacks on shipping in the world's most important oil artery since mid-May. Accusations Tehran rejects, but which have raised fears the longtime foes could stumble into war. It was unclear if the impounded ship was the same vessel towed to safety on Sunday after sending a distress signal. Iranian state television had earlier said it was the same ship, but the Revolutionary Guard statement did not confirm that. The Guard said the impounded ship was smuggling 1 million liters of fuel in the area of Larak Island in the Gulf and had 12 foreign crew members. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Also on Thursday, the Trump administration announced that a U.S. Navy ship had destroyed an Iranian drone in the Strait of Hormuz after the aircraft threatened the vessel. But Iran said it had no information about losing a drone. In the latest episode to spur tensions in the Gulf, Trump told an event at the White House that the drone had flown within 1,000 meters of the USS Boxer, an amphibious assault ship.
The Boxer took defensive action against an Iranian drone, which had closed into a very, very near distance, approximately 1,000 yards, ignoring multiple calls to stand down.
Tensions in the Gulf regions are high. The United States has blamed Iran for a series of attacks since mid-May on shipping around the Strait of Hormuz, the world's most important oil artery. Tehran rejects the allegations. Joining us to talk more about it is John Blaxland, Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us. So what is your reaction to the latest events?
A drone from Iran coming within 1,000 yards of USS Boxer, a amphibious ready ship, would be cause for considerable consternation. And given that Iran has already shot down a U.S. drone, it's not unreasonable that the United States should shoot down an Iranian drone approaching a U.S. warship without responding to requests for evasive action. So this is, in the grand scheme of things, we need to keep it in perspective. It's a reasonable, proportional response to a provocation.
There are concerns that with these tensions in the Gulf region so high, there are concerns that the United States and Iran could, maybe not even intentionally, but stumble into some sort of a war, which could have, I would imagine, pretty horrific consequences.
There remain considerable disincentives for escalation on both sides. While John Bolton remains hawkish, it seems like President Trump is using Bolton a bit like a pit bull on a chain. So he is intimidating with a view to getting Iran to back down and to make concessions, mindful that President Trump does not want to exercise that prerogative. And so the Iranians are reading this, and it's a bit of who's going to blink first. The Iranians appear to have seized a ship. They have shot down a U.S. drone earlier. The American response is proportional. The question now is, does Iran up the ante? I suspect that they may well continue because it's critical for Iran to break the level of support the United States has from Gulf states and from Europe and beyond. The fact that the United States sanctions are biting Iran is generating an urgency for Iran to react and to try and break through the uniformity, the agreement of coalition partners in the Gulf and beyond to stay with the United States, even though they may not all that be very keen to do so.
Iran also said on Thursday that it had, or signaled at least, a willingness to engage in diplomacy to diffuse the tensions with the United States, a modest offer on its nuclear program that obviously is, you know, being met with some skepticism, but they told reporters in New York that Iran would ratify the document prescribing more intrusive inspections into its nuclear program. What do you say about all that? Does that mean that these sanctions are working?
The sanctions are biting. There's no question. Iran really is in a bit of a bind. It needs to break through. It needs to come up with something new. It's either through intimidation or through compromise in negotiations. If the negotiations are agreed to, then that would be a win for President Trump. And it would maintain the hold on power of the Iranian regime. So it wouldn't be the complete victory that maybe President Trump and John Bolton might have wanted, but it would certainly be a face-saving victory for President Trump.
That's John Blaxland. He is a professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Taliban raid the Afghan provincial police headquarters. Sudan is urged to ensure justice for raped women protesters. Activists decry Botswana's appeal against legalizing gay sex. And pregnant women overseas lose access to prenatal care due to Trump's global gag rule. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, it's been a trying week for American democracy. President Donald Trump has come under fire for verbal attacks on four minority Democratic congresswomen. The House of Representatives, largely on party lines, voted to condemn some of the president's comments as racist. At the same time, opposition Democrats remain divided over whether to try to impeach Trump or focus on defeating him in next year's presidential election. The clash has plunged the country into an angry debate over race, immigration, and political ideology, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone in Washington.
Before an enthusiastic crowd in North Carolina, President Trump unleashed yet another attack on four Democrats in Congress, all women of color.
These left-wing ideologues see our nation as a force of evil, the way they speak so badly of our country. They want to demolish our Constitution, weaken our military, eliminate the values that built this magnificent country.
At one point in his rally, the president targeted Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, prompting chants of "send her back" from the crowd.
Send her back.
Trump's combative appearance came on the same day the House voted to set aside an effort by some Democrats to initiate impeachment proceedings against him. But earlier in the week, the House did take the unusual step of voting to condemn some of Trump's attacks on the four lawmakers as racist. All House Democrats supported the resolution, including civil rights icon John Lewis of Georgia.
I know racism when I see it. I know racism when I feel it. And at the highest level of government, there's no room for racism.
President Trump's victory in 2016 was spurred by strong support from white working class voters. But many Democrats believe the president is now making a dangerous bid for support based on racial resentment, including Congressman Tom Malinowski.
These words are not just words. They are like gasoline. They are like a spark to the gasoline of disturbed minds.
Trump denies he's a racist, but he has slammed the four congresswomen as socialists and urged them to leave the country if they are unhappy. Some Republicans have complained about the attacks, but many others, including Senator John Kennedy, support the president.
This is not China. This is not North Korea. This is America. And if you hate our country, you're free to leave anytime you want to.
The president's raw focus on racial and ideological strains is tearing at the fabric of the country, warns Democratic Congressman Dean Phillips.
And if racism ever becomes a partisan issue in this country, we have done a woeful disservice to our founders. We have done a woeful disservice to our Constitution and a woeful disservice to every single person that calls America home.
The president's narrow victory in 2016 and his relatively low approval rating leaves him vulnerable for re-election, says analyst Kyle Cunningham.
Because if his approval rating is under 45, then he's going to need a significant share of people who don't approve of him to vote for him, and that's when it becomes really difficult.
This week's rhetorical fireworks likely serve as a preview for what could be an ugly and volatile presidential campaign next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Some pregnant women in developing countries have lost access to prenatal health care due to the Trump administration's expanded global gag rule that cuts international assistance to organizations involved in performing or promoting abortion. VOA's Brian Padden has this report.
Family Health Options Kenya has closed or reduced its family planning services nationwide after losing $2 million in U.S. funding since 2018.
The global gag rule was also very comprehensive because it did not allow organizations even to provide family planning, which is basically our core mandate as an organization.
The U.S. global gag rule blocks around $8.8 billion of U.S. international health assistance to organizations that provide abortion services, offer pro-abortion counseling, or advocate for the liberalization of abortion laws. Since 1984, these partisan restrictions have been enacted by Republican presidents and rescinded by Democratic presidents. Before losing the U.S. funding, the Kenyan Health Network reached an estimated 76,000 people annually. Some family planning clinics in the developing world are often the only local health providers, not only for prenatal care, but also for HIV screenings, children's vaccinations, and contraceptives. U.S. anti-abortion groups such as the National Right to Life Committee say the impact of global gag rule restrictions have been exaggerated by opponents. They note that over 700 international aid organizations are still receiving nearly all of the allocated global health assistance funding.
It's only a handful of organizations that refuse to accept the money for these services because the right to kill unborn children is more important to them.
Tobias says private donations are making up for the canceled U.S. government contributions, but some health organizations in Africa say they have not received enough outside funding to make up for the cuts. In March, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expanded the global gag rule to reduce assistance to the Organization of American States for funding of third-party groups that lobby for legalizing abortion in Latin America. Global gag rule opponents object to the Trump administration imposing what they say are partisan, politically driven restrictions over providing comprehensive medical information and treatment.
So you're asking doctors to sort of choose between politics set in Washington or actually the health and ethical decisions set in their own countries.
Supporting critics' claims that the global gag rule does more harm than good. A recent study in the Lancet Global Health Journal reported a 40% increase in abortion rates in Africa during past periods when the restrictions were in place. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma has spent 3 days testifying at a corruption inquiry that looks into numerous allegations of cronyism and undue influence on state organs during his time in office. But is Zuma bringing answers to light, or is he raising more questions? Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa has yet to hear many actual answers from Jacob Zuma on how private interests allegedly influenced government decisions for years, leading to dubious high-level appointments. But what Zuma has provided this week during his testimony at the so-called State Capture Commission is plenty of drama. In 3 days of near-constant talking, the former leader, whose party pressured him to resign last year, has alleged that some top politicians are spies, complained the inquiry is unfair, and said his life is now at risk.
I just thought, for record, this commission must know that my life and my children, my lawyers, are now under threat.
That was Zuma on Tuesday, on the second day of his testimony in Johannesburg. The Judicial Commission of Inquiry into Allegations of State Capture, Corruption, and Fraud in the Public Sector has now gone on for more than a year and seen dozens of witnesses. At the center of this drama is a wealthy family, the Guptas. The Gupta family is said to have been so close to Zuma that several top politicians testified that the family offered them high-level cabinet positions in exchange for beneficial commercial decisions. The highest-profile Gupta family member fled South Africa shortly after Zuma resigned, and this week, Zuma's lawyer, Thabani Masuku, has argued that the family's absence is a problem.
It's highly unfair. If the Guptas are not going to be here to testify and to corroborate what Mr. Masego has said here, it's just unfair to ask the president to recall or to interpret what role he may have played in the removal of Mr. Masego.
The lawyer was referring to Thembo Maseko, who left his job as a government communications spokesman in 2011 and recently testified on Zuma's close ties to the Gupta family. Maseko was replaced after allegedly refusing to direct government advertising contracts to the Gupta's now-defunct media businesses. Corruption was a central issue during this year's election, and President Cyril Ramaphosa won re-election on an anti-corruption platform. Under Zuma, the nation saw numerous fruitless anti-corruption inquiries. But Ronald Chauke of the Organization of Undoing Tax Abuse, a South African watchdog, says he hopes things will be different this time, because Ramaphosa has said he will allow the commissions to do their work. Chauke also questions the testimony Zuma has offered this week.
To be honest with you, he was falling short. Basically, it shows you that it's like all of a sudden he remembers things that happened by the 1960s, 40, 50 years ago, but when he has to remember critical things that happened recently in the last 3 years or 4 years, he tends to say that he doesn't remember, doesn't recall. So basically, he's having a convenient amnesia, of which for me actually is deliberate lying and a deliberate withholding of critical information to the commission.
Zuma is set to testify for one more day on Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum will be leading festivities here in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing on July 20th, 1969. The celebration includes a full-sized projection of the Apollo Saturn V rocket on the iconic Washington Monument. Back in 1969, VOA produced a documentary on Apollo 11's moon landing. Here is a sampling of our coverage of that mission.
This is VOA correspondent Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy, Florida. I'm standing about 5 kilometers from the point where a Saturn V rocket stands bathed in a wreath of brilliant light. Atop the rocket, inside the Apollo spacecraft, named Columbia, after Jules Verne's spacecraft, are the first men who will attempt to land on the moon. The beaches, fields, and highways surrounding the Kennedy Space Center bustle with people, an estimated crowd of several hundred thousand, seeking the best vantage points to witness the launch of the astronauts. Their mood is tense and expectant. Many have slept on the beach or in their cars, bundled up against the chilling dampness of the subtropical night. It looks as if Jules Verne's imagination had come to life.
T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
As the astronauts go where man has never gone before, as they attempt what man has never tried, we on Earth will want, as one people, to be with them in spirit, to share the glory and the wonder, and to support them with prayers that all will go well.
30 seconds. Forward. Contact light.
Okay, engine stop. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The first words uttered by a man as he set foot on the surface of the moon. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. It was taken at 56 minutes past the hour of 2, Greenwich Mean Time, on the 21st day of July, 1969.
Well, 50 years ago, or 50 years after humans first set foot on the moon, the rock samples collected by Apollo astronauts are still being studied by volcanologists, that's people who study volcanoes, who believe that they learn what they learn could predict eruptions on Earth more accurately. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translation.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues in the heart of New York City, where some of the biggest actors get their start. A brand new film festival is highlighting women, and it's just opened this week. The 51 Fest's inaugural event is the process has been women, putting women at the center of the story. The festival builds on the mission of the Women in the World Summit, founded in 2009 to amplify and celebrate women and women's voices. Joining us to talk more about the event is 51 Fest Program Director Ann Hubble. Ann, tell us all about it.
It's a festival that celebrates the voice and vision of the female majority through screenings and conversations that are by or about women. The idea is to put women at the center of the story, and it's called 51 Fest because we make up the majority of the population.
So there are more women, and yet it seems like they're still getting paid less. We haven't really hit equality yet at this point. Is that a safe assumption?
51% of moviegoers are female. That is true. And on screen and behind the camera as well, there certainly is not parity. So one of the things that we want to address at 51 Fest is representation and making sure that we are recognizing women in front of the camera, behind the camera, in episodic work, narrative movies, documentaries, and in the political arena via a really fantastic conversation that we'll be having with the founders of Supermajority that will focus on some of their specific stories of advocacy and how they've been making change.
Tell us a little bit about the event, about the lineup and some of the bigger things that you are really trying to showcase here and people.
So the opening night is Kathy Griffin, A Hell of a Story. It's a documentary slash concert film that Kathy made. It tells her story of what happened to her after a social media photo was posted featuring her holding a mask of Donald Trump and everything that happened to her as fallout from that photo. She was under federal investigation. She was on the no-fly list. She lost her job. And really, a lot of things happened to her because she was exercising her First Amendment right that I think could happen to any of us. And it makes that program really compelling. People have an opinion of Kathy, and if you think you know her, that's one thing. But once you see the movie, I think you have a different understanding of who she is and also just the resilience that she's had, because she took that experience and turned it into a show that is really funny, and it's also informative and a little bit heartbreaking. So we're very excited that that's opening night. She'll be in conversation with Tina Brown right after the screening. Tina, from the beginning, was very interested in this movie, and so I think it kicks the festival off in a really nice way.
You've got 4 days of these films featuring women.
So we have 11 programs in total and 40 guests coming to the festival. Each screening will be followed by a conversation that features actors, filmmakers, subjects of movies, journalists that are coming to moderate. And it's one thing that really sets the festival apart is this component of having a discussion after the film. And it's really how the Women in the World piece fits in. So we are really excited about that part of things.
Who came up with this idea to have this festival? And do you expect it to start being an annual event?
The idea for the festival came from the IFC Center approaching Tina Brown and her Women in the World organization. They wanted to do something that was a women's film festival, but set it apart a bit. And so they wanted to partner with Women in the World, have some elevated conversations, and make each and every screening a special event. And we do expect that we'll have another one next year, and it will be an annual event. We'll see how this one goes.
All right. That's 51 Fest Program Director Anne Hubble. All the best with the event. Still wearing black spandex and with multiple costume changes, Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones rocked the Mercedes-Benz Superdome in New Orleans Monday night. Fans attending the concert were blown away with their reaction, saying the group were just as good as they were over 50 years ago. The crowd included not just baby boomers enjoying their classic hits, but also a younger generation who rocked out to what seemed to them like brand new music. The concert was postponed by a day due to Tropical Storm Barry bearing down on New Orleans. The British group, which normally opens every concert with the song Street Fighting Man, surprised the crowd with a show of patriotism for America by opening with a rock version of the Star-Spangled Banner, followed by their hit Jumpin' Jack Flash, with Jagger's very fitting lyrics given the storm that said, quote, "I was born in a crossfire hurricane." You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Political